individuals who are placed in jail instead of a therapeutic environment have aggravated symptoms as a result of that placement.
Concern over diverting mental health patients from psych wards to jail facilities. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the Census Bureau is trying to get rural Alaskans to help with the next big count.
Having local residents enumerate within their own communities ensures an accurate count.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
A small number of Alaskans experiencing psychiatric crises are being diverted from healthcare facilities to Department of Corrections facilities. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, critics worry the emergency measure is not only unlawful, but putting patients in jeopardy.
Since last Friday, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute has had to reduce the number of available beds due to staffing and safety concerns. With fewer beds available, individuals being committed under what's known in Alaska as Title 47 are being brought to private hospitals, but also to state-run correctional facilities. So far, four patients in need of acute mental care have been put under holds inside jail or prison buildings. Dwayne Mays is the CEO of API, and he says right now the facility has several high-need patients who require multiple staffers to be on hand out of safety concerns. That's reducing the number of available beds from 58 to 49.
When we realize we cannot take more, we inform those entities such as the hospital, DOC, that we're not able to do that because of the capacity issue.
Mays is relatively new to his role at API, but says that staff have told him it is not unprecedented for patients to be sent to correctional facilities for emergency psychiatric care. But not everyone agrees. Laura Brooks, who works with DOC's Division of Health and Rehabilitation, says the department is not accustomed to absorbing mental health patients who have no criminal charges against them.
So this is a new process for us.
Brooks says that in the Anchorage area, those committed involuntarily because of substance abuse issues that pose a threat to themselves or others are being sent to the Anchorage Correctional Complex or Highland Mountain.
We have mental health units for the criminal population, and so we are going to house them on those units in separate cells, but we will house them on those units. We'll not be putting these individuals in our general population areas.
Brooks says of the four Title 47 patients put into DOC custody during the last week, one has since been released. Retired mental health court judge Stephanie Rhodes thinks this practice is a misapplication of involuntary commitment laws that puts patients in jeopardy. In an email, Rhodes says the laws for Title 47 allow individuals to be held in jails only as a last resort. For example, it's meant to be applied in rural areas from inclement weather or while awaiting plane transport to the psychiatric institute. Use of correctional facilities as an overflow option, she writes, was never the intention and is a violation of patients' rights. And David Florent with the Disability Law Center says housing psychiatric patients in jails can impede their recovery.
There's a significant difference between being placed in jail and placed in a psychiatric facility that provides treatment and care for someone who has a mental illness. I was reading one case wherein individuals who are placed in jail instead of a therapeutic environment have aggravated symptoms as a result of that placement.
Florent says the state has not been adequately transparent about why it decided to put patients in correctional facilities rather than in nearby hospitals. Psychiatric Institute says each day it's evaluating whether it can open more bed space for new patients. In the meantime, DOC says correctional centers around the state are preparing to potentially house patients needing urgent mental health care. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Two former executives at one of Alaska's largest hospitals claim they lost their jobs for trying to stop illegal billing practices and for raising other concerns. The Anchorage Daily News reports the former officials filed a federal lawsuit against the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium after they lost their jobs in 2016. They filed an amended complaint this summer. A former chief ethics and compliance officer and former chief medical officer say the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage, operated by the consortium, double-billed for certain drugs and improperly billed for services delivered by ineligible providers. The tribal health organization says the complaints are not true. Attorneys declined to say why the two lost their jobs, noting the consortium stands by its personnel decisions. As the midterm elections approach, the Bristol Bay Native Corporation will remain neutral on ballot measure 1. The Bristol Bay Native Association passed a resolution at a full board meeting on September 28th asking BBNC to reconsider its neutrality on ballot measure 1. The ballot measure put forward by the group Stand for Salmon aims to strengthen laws protecting salmon habitat in the state. Critics say the measure could be too far-reaching in the types of development that it would hinder. Joe Chythluk, chairman of the BBNC board, confirmed that they discussed the resolution at an October 5th board meeting. According to Chythluk, the board decided to remain neutral on the initiative following the advice of their executive team. The executive team declined to comment further. Voters will decide whether ballot measure one in the November 6th election. One of the most important tools for ensuring government representation and the distribution of federal funds relies on neighbors counting neighbors. The 2020 United States Census is more than a year away, but government officials are already planning. And the first person in the nation to be counted is in rural Alaska. The 2010 census began in Norvik with Clifton Jackson, a World War II veteran and the community's oldest resident. Census manager Corey Novy says Norvik and Jackson were both selected after a long vetting process.
We work with local organizations and groups to get recommendations on the first tribe. And then the tribal chairman actually picks the first person in the nation to be enumerated.
The tradition of starting the count in rural Alaska began in 1990. For the 2020 census, the census committee is down to a short list of three potential communities for that first count. Novy says they expect to make an announcement soon.
And every tribe that we've worked with in the past when we've done this has considered this really an honor to kick off the census.
The census will begin in January of 2020 in rural Alaska. The rest of the nation will begin its count 3 months later in March. The reason Novy says is because of weather and seasonal schedules. Spring breakup, storms, subsistence activities, and weather-dependent transportation issues in rural Alaska require an early start. It's also great publicity for the census to begin in Alaska. In 2010, when Clifton Jackson was the first person counted, the national director of the Census Bureau, Robert Groves, flew to Norvik. He rode a dog sled from the airstrip to the school, where he ate whale meat with village elders before walking to Clifton Jackson's door. And rural Alaska is one of the few places where people will be walking door-to-door counting people using paper surveys. Most of the nation in 2020 will be using a computer app. You could be one of the enumerators in your community. The census is hiring, and the pay is pretty good. $28 per hour for enumerators. Supervisors will be paid even more. The census wants these positions filled by local workers with knowledge of the community and language.
Having local residents enumerate within their own communities ensures an accurate count.
An accurate count, especially for federally recognized tribes, is critical. The population and household data gathered in the census largely dictates the federal funds tribes will receive for the next decade. To apply for a census position online, visit 2020census.gov/jobs. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, three Fairbanks groups are suing the EPA over air quality.
Unfortunately, it's become politicized, but I think we view it as necessary to health and well-being.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state from Valdez, Anchorage, and more. Information at flyraven.com.
Three environmental groups announced this week they intend to sue the Federal Environmental Protection Agency for what they say is its failure to require the Fairbanks North Star Borough to reduce air pollution. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The three groups that announced their intention to sue the EPA include Fairbanks-based Citizens for Clean Air. Member Patrice Lee says the goal is simply to get the agency to do its job in requiring the state and borough to clean up the Fairbanks area's air.
The borough's been working at it along with state for over 10 years, and we haven't reached the goal of cleaner air. The law is clear. We need to obey the law and to clean up the air.
The local group, along with the Sierra Club and Anchorage-based Alaska Community Action on Toxics, notified the EPA Wednesday of their intent to sue the agency. Officials with the groups say the lawsuit would seek to require the EPA to enforce provisions of the Federal Clean Air Act that require the borough and state to reduce the level of health-damaging PM2.5. The tiny particles emitted by wood stoves and other sources accumulate in the air around Fairbanks during inversions on cold winter days, creating the worst air quality in the nation.
It's a matter of health and safety. Unfortunately, it's become politicized, but I think we view it as necessary to health and well-being.
Some area residents have for years fought the borough and its efforts to develop and enforce air quality regulations to reduce PM2.5, especially within the so-called non-attainment area that encompasses much of Fairbanks and North Pole. Last week, opponents of the efforts to reduce PM2.5 succeeded in passing ballot measure Proposition 4, which strips the borough of its authority to enforce air quality regulations. But Lee says that's not why the groups are threatening to sue.
This wasn't a knee-jerk reaction to Prop 4 by any stretch.
Lee says the groups had been planning for months to issue the notice of intent to sue because they say the EPA has for the fourth time missed a deadline to improve air quality enough to attain the standards set in the Clean Air Act. The groups say EPA is at fault for the State Department of Environmental Conservation's failure to come up with a plan to bring the Fairbanks area into compliance with conditions set when EPA declared it a serious non-attainment area.
They had to come forward with a state implementation plan, an SIP, that would address the issue. And they have not done that.
State and borough officials say they're still working on that plan. If the groups follow through with the lawsuit threat, it would be the third such suit they've filed in the past 4 years over the issue. Lee says today's notice of intent starts a 60-day clock that could result in a lawsuit.
The EPA has 60 days to appeal to the state to comply with the requirements of the Clean Air Act. On day 61, if they have not submitted a SIP that can be considered complete by the EPA, we will file the suit.
As in previous lawsuits, the groups will be represented by the Denver-based organization Earth Justice. Lee says she and other local air quality advocates understand the difficulty that many area residents face in converting their home heating systems from wood to cleaner burning fuels. And she says she appreciates efforts by many wood burners to work with the advocates.
Citizens in the borough have tried to come together, and we do recognize each other's frustrations. There are legitimate frustrations on both sides of this issue, but the bottom line is there are many ways to heat a home and only one way to breathe.
The Borough Assembly will convene a special meeting tonight to talk with legal staff about how to respond to the passage of Proposition 4. They're also likely to talk about the latest potential air quality lawsuit. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Leland Hale, along with his late co-author Walter Gilmore, is known for writing the book Butcher Baker about Anchorage serial killer Robert Hansen in the 1970s and early 80s. Which more recently was made into a movie. And Hale went back to the 1980s Alaska for the subject of his new book, What Happened in Craig, out this week. It was the end of the fishing season in 1982 in tiny Craig, Alaska. The town was full of fishing boats and fishermen, and after a night of celebrating, nobody could find 28-year-old Mark Colthurst, his boat, the investor, or his crew, kids, or wife, who was pregnant. Hale says what happened next rocked the community and set off one of the most perplexing murder mysteries in Alaska history.
The next day, people try to contact his boat. Some people see the vessel about a mile and a half out from Craig. Then the next thing we know, this vessel is on fire. When they finally get the fire tamped down, they discover bodies. They found four at that time. Four. Out of eight. First of all, you have sort of two crime scenes because the killings were probably on the dock in Craig. So that's one crime scene. But there's a second crime scene, which is the boat. It was a year before they discovered someone that they thought was a suspect. It was another year before there was an arrest, a guy named John Peel, who had worked for the Colthursts on their previous boat. Then it was another 2 years before the first trial. And that trial was in Ketchikan. It was a hung jury. So then there was a second trial, and that moved to Juneau. And John Peel was acquitted. So we don't know who did it. Whoever did it is still out there. This person would be now in his 50s, but that's all we know.
Going back and talking to people about events that happened in the past and tracking people down, that's difficult in any circumstance, but especially in something tragic like this, I imagine it's really tough to get people to talk to you.
Well, it got tougher later because there was a civil suit filed by John Peel and his attorneys. So people kind of clamped down. But I did most of my research in the early 90s. And then I relied heavily on the court records because, as it turned out, the prosecuting attorney, Marianne Henry, had all of the records, even the stuff that the jury did not see or hear, put in the Alaska State Archive in Juneau. So I had a very rich body of work there. And then I was able to talk to a couple of troopers. In fact, I talked extensively to a guy named Trooper Bob Anderson, who was the first guy on the scene. And really his description of what was going on, what was going through his head, what he saw is how I opened the book, because it's so immediate. I mean, this guy was not expecting to find bodies. And he had nightmares after that. I talked to one of the detectives who did the scene investigation on the boat. And I was really lucky to talk to the first judge, who gave me sort of the judge's view of the trial.
Through this reporting, you know, doing this book, have you reached a conclusion on who you think was the real killer?
I haven't. There's not really a strong basis in fact. It was a circumstantial case from the very beginning. They never identified a motive. Speculation. There, some people speculate it was drug related, that because this guy had a $1 million boat and he owed a lot of money, he was, you know, dealing cocaine. That's not proven. He wasn't an Alaska fisherman. So maybe there's a rivalry there that just kind of blew up. Again, there were 150 boats in Craig at that time. That's a lot of people. It was the end of the season. So they quickly dispersed. I mean, I think somebody out there knows who did it and just didn't come forward.
Well, Leland, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Leland Hale is the author of the new book, What Happened in Craig, the true story of what many consider the worst unsolved murder in Alaska history. Next week, the 35th annual Elders and Youth Conference kicks off at the Dena'ina Convention Center in Anchorage. The three-day event organized by the First Alaskans Institute is designed to strengthen intergenerational relationships and develop Indigenous leadership across Alaska. This year's theme is Our Ancestors, Our Fire. Keynote speakers include 92-year-old Inupiaq elder Ugyaktek Wesley Aiken from Utqiagvik and 20-year-old Tristan Yado Jovan Madros from Caltag. Organizers anticipate more than 1,000 participants to attend. Elders and Youth precedes the annual Alaska Federation of Natives convention each year. Elders and Youth runs from October 15th to 17th, and AFN's main convention starts on Thursday the 18th and concludes on Saturday the 20th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Starting October 1st, all of Alaska will be protected from the harmful effects of secondhand smoke because all public places across the state will be smoke-free. Everyone can now breathe easier as they work and play. Smoke-free workplaces and public spaces protects the health of all Alaskans. It also protects our youth from ever starting smoking. So if you do smoke or vape, please take it outside. For more information about the new smoke-free workplace law, visit smokefree.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmiut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, new traditions. Monday marked the second year for Alaskans to commemorate Indigenous Peoples Day rather than the federal Columbus Day holiday. And in Ketchikan, a local campus library hosted their own celebration of Indigenous culture. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
A table is filled with food made from traditional ingredients: smoked salmon, beach asparagus dip, berry jams, and scones. High school students from the Tribal Scholars Program are gathered filling their plates. Those students are all Alaska Native or Native American, and they made posters that are hanging on the walls of the UAS Ketchikan Campus Library. Each poster represents Native culture in any way the student chose. But teacher Barbara Morgan says it had to follow the theme, sense of place. And she made the assignment specific to science because that's her area of specialty.
So I also had them use their senses to make an observation that would tie into like the scientific process, which starts with an observation. So it's kind of, they did a good job.
Ronnie Robert Pungawi is Siberian Yupik, and his poster is about seal and sea otter hunting.
It's one of the things I like grew up on, my father taught me how to do with hunting and fishing, and I think seal and sea otter hunting is like my most favorite things to hunt.
Pungawi says he learned the traditional hunting methods and has been hunting since he was 2 years old. He says Indigenous Peoples Day to him means learning where he came from. Brooke Edenshaw says the day helps Alaska Natives be proud of who they are. Her poster focuses on the kuspuk, a traditional Yupik garment worn by women.
They were initially for like to keep fur parkas clean, and they were made out of animal gut and like skin. Now they're commonly made out of like cotton and like silk. It's just designed with rickrack.
Edenshaw is Yupik and says she has a couple of kuspuks at home, but she has outgrown them. In addition to the posters, some tables in the library display traditional items made by Alaska Native residents. Merle Hawkins makes all kinds of products from Devil's Club. She says the formidable plant hides important traditional medicine under all those thorns.
I brought a fresh piece of Devil's Club so they could see it, feel it, smell it, touch it.
And usually you don't want to touch Devil's Club, so.
I softened it up some, so I scraped the thorns off right away. Yeah.
So how do you harvest it without hurting yourself?
I use thick leather gloves, and I saw it down. First thing I do is scrape the thorns off, and then you get, there's a thin brown layer of bark. I scrape that one off next, and then the green layer is the third layer. That's the bark for the medicine.
Hawkins says that green layer can be dried and used as a medicinal tea for arthritis or stomach problems. It also can be put in a jar with olive oil. After a while, the Devil's Club bark infuses the oil with its medicinal qualities, and the oil can be used to make ointment and other products. Hawkins is Haida and says local Indigenous people have been using Devil's Club bark for thousands of years. They learned about it from watching bears rolling on the thorny plant.
In the summertime, the needles and everything, they slough off because the sap is flowing, and then it's real moist next to the bark. So good medicine even for the animals, I think.
Hawkins says to her, Indigenous Peoples Day highlights the challenges Alaska Natives have overcome and their resiliency in maintaining their culture. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Gloria Johnson in Anchorage. Johnson is the superintendent of the Highland Mountain Correctional Center in Eagle River.
I'm married to a military man. He was in the Air Force, so we got an assignment up here. And when we got here, usually they rotate us out 3 to 4 years. So he extended, and I begged him, please, can you try to stay here? Because there are no snakes here. We were originally from Arkansas to Texas, which have snakes. Both states have snakes. So he graciously, he went away to Saudi Arabia for a year without us so we could stay here. I met some people and they told me, your first winter, either you're going to love it or you're going to hate it. And then we came more in March. So the summertime was what we had to get used to, because it would be 11 o'clock, 11, 12 o'clock at night. I hadn't put my children to bed yet because it was still light. The sun was still shining. So those were some of the things we learned how to adjust, how to. Back then, we didn't have blackout curtains, so we used aluminum foil to help reflect the light. Now we have blackout curtains. And one of the things, too, is I have a child that the winter times affect her, so she has a happy light because she needs the sunshine. I can go out, I can fish, I can just walk, pick berries, hunt, do anything. Don't have to worry about snakes. This sounds really weird. My favorite Alaska memory is really driving through the tunnel going to Whittier. It really is. That was exciting. I really thought it was going to be different because I've gone through tunnels like when we stationed up on the East Coast, those tunnels. But the Whittier tunnel is a little different. By the time you think maybe it's a little nervous or scared, you're already out on the other end. So that's, and then you're right there in the city, you know, if you can call it Whittier a city. So that's one of my favorite things too. And I like driving, going down the Seward Highway, especially when the tide's in, and you may see a whale out there. That's exciting too, wildlife. I just mentioned to my husband on Sunday, I said, after church, why don't we just take a ride down the highway, you know, Seward Highway. He said, I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to get me to take you to the Double Muskie. I said, no, I'm really not. I just want to drive and just look at the inlet, look at the scenery. I really appreciate God's beauty. I really do.
Gloria Johnson lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Layla Carey, Wesley Early, and Kirsten Swan. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media or follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss proposals to change federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations and other subsistence-related issues, and invites public participation at a meeting October 16th through 18th starting at 8:30 a.m. at the Sitka Tribal Community House. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.